This episode will include sensitive content. Please visit the show notes for more details and listen at your own discretion. Welcome to PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr., and I'm so excited to have Major Anthony L., a longtime friend and a man with decades of experience in law enforcement, on the show today.
Because when you buying dope, there's no script, and you have to think on your feet, and you got to think real fast, especially when guns are being pointed at you, people accusing you of being the police. Who are you? Where you come from?
He hails from Kansas City, Missouri, born and raised, where he was head of the homicide unit for many years and has seen some pretty incredible cases.
So all of a sudden, we're stacked, and we're in that fatal funnel in that doorway. And at the end of that doorway time, there's a guy, and he has a pistol in his hand, and he starts shooting.
My old friend Major L, welcome. I'm so glad to have you on the show.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, I went to Kansas City in 2001 to work on a case with your department. I had no idea what kind of a big city it was, and I fell in love with Kansas City.
It's a city that surprises a lot of people in the size. When you include the metropolitan statistical reporting area for the entire, on both sides of the state line, the suburbs, everything there, we go up to a population of about 2.5 million. Mm. 2.5 million. The Kansas City, Missouri Police Department is the major police department in the region. And I'm proud to say that I'm a proud member of the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. Now, some other things about Kansas City, Tom. Of course, everybody knows Kansas City is the barbecue capital of the world.
Yes, sir.
Barbecue, yes, sir. Second to none. We have the best barbecue you will find anywhere.
Now, you were part of the street narcotics unit at one point. What did you do, and what were some of the experiences you had that really stand out, and perhaps maybe even the most chilling experiences you had?
Oh, yes. Street narcotics unit. So back in the mid-80s, they didn't like the term SWAT here. So they called it the support unit, but basically it was a SWAT team. So I was a SWAT officer. So what we did was we handled all the barricade subjects, search warrants, and then when we wasn't out doing that or training, we were out chasing bad guys, working with homicide, working with the detectives and property crimes, narcotics, everybody who needed some help in finding somebody. We did a lot of different things. Well, in 85, crack hit Kansas City. Crack hit Kansas City 6 months probably after it hit the East Coast. Well, from 85 after it hit in Kansas City, that crack cocaine epidemic was just out of control. And there were so many open-air drug markets, drug houses that our narcotics unit couldn't keep up with the calls and the complaints and all the things that were going on with those. So we had a colonel, and he decided he wanted to create a street, what he called a street narcotics unit. So all we dealt with was street level narcotics activity, the small dealers, and the drug houses. So the concept was you had one squad that were undercover, and they actually did all the buys. The squad that I was on, we handled all the search warrants. So the undercovers would go out, they'd make the buys, get the search warrant on the house, and once we got it, we would then evaluate the threat level, execute the search warrant, and then we would actually process the house. Well, when you process a drug house, that means with the detection dog coming in, checking for drugs, and then the actual searching process of any arrest on the inside, identifying, you know, who had warrants, who was possibly your sellers, and all those things. And sometimes there was so much drugs, cash, and other contraband that was an 8-hour job just counting cash. I can remember one house that we found a shoebox up in the attic, two shoeboxes. And the shoebox with the lid on it was a Nike shoebox, was literally stuffed with cash.
Well, Dope boys love shoeboxes. Dope boys love to put money in shoeboxes. They do.
They do. Well, and that takes time, Tom. And I can remember, we have a dog come in, and we had certain dogs that if that dog indicated or started hitting on a wall and that wall was plastered or whatever, you better get the tools and whatever, because it's inside that wall. The dogs were that good. And I can remember one, and there was a church's chicken box. And it was inside the plastic, and he hit on the box. Well, the handler thought the dog was trying to get it, thought it was chicken in there. So he kicked the box. So I went over and picked up the box and the bag, and I opened it up and pulled it out, and it was full of money. So that's what the dog was sitting on. Yeah.
So you're in this house, and there's a church's chicken bag, and the canine alerts on it.
Yes.
But it turns out it's not drugs in it. There's money in it. How does that work with the dog being able to detect the money?
Well, the dogs are trained to narcotics detection. They train the dogs for a variety of narcotics. Well, when most of the times, especially back then with crack cocaine, when they're in those drug houses and they're handling drugs, they're handling money, that residue from those drugs are on that money. And the dog is not really actually hitting on the money. He's hitting on the drug residue that's on the money. And that's where they're trained. So when we were not doing search warrants, and the undercovers didn't have warrants, we go out and do buy busts. So we would go out to a particular location, a corner or something like that. There was an active open air drug market, and we would make a buy. And then we would actually, the arrest team would come in and swoop in on the seller or sellers in some cases. We never had any situation during a buy bust where it got really, really scary or really, really, you know, crazy in terms of violence or shots fired or anything like that. The only time that we had in a situation like that was on serving a search warrant, because there was always that possibility when you went in that door, after you knock, announce your presence, you force the door, you go inside, that somebody might violently resist. So we had an incident like that that happened to us. We were in Kansas City serving a search warrant just like any others. Everything was fine until we hit that door. No sooner than we hit that door and that door goes flying open, and I was three in line. And in the entry team, I was number three. The other two guys, and it's kind of like back then, most teams, we were stair step. So you had the shorter guy, then a little taller, and as you keep going back in the lineup, because you have to be able to see over people. So I'm 6'3". So naturally, the two guys in front of me have to be shorter, so they were shorter. So all of a
sudden—that's what you call the stack. That's what they call the stack.
That's the stack. Yeah. So all of a sudden, we're stacked, and we're in that fatal funnel in that doorway. And at the end of that doorway time, there's a guy, and he has a pistol in his hand, and he starts shooting. And so, when you're in that doorway, and you're the third person, you're not in a position to shoot. Right. You have to depend on one and two in front of you taking care of that threat. So that's basically what they did. So the guy retreated through a back hallway and then down, and he fell right in front of the door of a bedroom. So once he fell in front of the bedroom, he still had the gun in his hand. We went down that hallway, secured him, kept going, and unfortunately, he died of his injury. But when they came out and they were investigating it, the bullet that he shot went over the point man's head, right in between my head and the number two man's head, through the door and across the street in the garage. And the good Lord was with me that night. He was with me that night. So that was probably, and then the other night, one that night I'll never forget, and I'll never forget short time later. And he's still a good friend of mine. He was on the undercover side. And Tom, this guy was one of the best that I've ever seen in my career. Because when you buying dope, there's no script, there's no procedure or anything you follow. You get training and everything, but every time you buy dope, it's always something different. And you have to think on your feet, and you gotta think real fast, especially when guns are being pointed at you, people are accusing you of being the police, who are you, where you come from. Well, he was at, we had gotten a warrant for a house, and we were going to serve the search warrant. And in the first time that they were dealing with these guys over there, the guys were a little aggressive. So he came and he came to us that night, and he said, "Well, Tony, can y'all be a little close tonight?" And I said, "Yeah, we can. What's wrong?" And he said, told me about, you know, the first interaction. So he said, "But I'm good. I'll go up there and try to make the buy and see what's happening." So we're staged probably a lot closer than what we normally would be. We're within a half a block of it. So he goes up, and they're monitoring him. The other undercovers are monitoring him. And we can tell by on the radio that something wasn't right. And so once we heard the commotion and everything going on, we came around that corner, came down the block, and he was laying on the sidewalk and motioning us and pointing toward the house, and they had shot him. So we went in, and at that time, we knew he'd been shot, got an ambulance for him, but we still went in on the warrant, secured everybody in the house. He ended up surviving, you know, of course, a friend of mine now, the gunshot wounds. And actually, after he got released back to full duty, he came back to street narcotics.
Now, you've had a number, and you always had a nose for some big arrests. You had one in your rookie year that was a hard one to crack. What was that about?
Well, Tom, you know, it was actually, I was an officer. And it was right around my rookie year. I'd still consider myself a rookie, but it was actually a homicide that occurred in Kansas City off of 43rd and Wabash. It seems like Wabash is a pretty familiar street with a lot of things going on, but Wabash is where it was at. So I had a sergeant, and the sergeant's name was Benny Casey. So Benny Casey had just got promoted to sergeant. He came from Metro. Benny came to me and he was my new sergeant. So Benny came to me and he had heard that I was a pretty good officer. And he said, well, if you think you're so good, you're a pretty good officer. I had this homicide in my sector. And he told me what happened in the homicide. And he told me who the guy's name was that he was looking for. And he's been charged now. This guy's name was Tony Friends. Never forget his name. So I said, okay, let me see what I can do. So I had some information from some guys on the streets about who I was looking for. So he told me, you can find him. He comes, he drives a gold Cadillac, and he always comes around 31st in Cleveland. I said, okay. So I'm working East Zone, and I'm driving around and keep my eye out for this gold Cadillac. And one day, there it is, over there just like he said. So I followed him, and he goes down into Center Zone around 11th and Park. There was a set of townhomes on the north side of the street. So he pulls back there with him. So I get on the phone, or he didn't have phones then. We had radios. So I get on the radio and said to Sarge, meet me and tell him what we had. And could we, I had another officer with me, Tyrone Lee is who it was. And I asked, could we do a surveillance on the guy? He said, yeah, you can. So Tom, we wasn't there. Normally surveillances, you can be there from anywhere from a shift or 24 hours. They usually don't go quick. Whenever they say surveillance, you might as well get prepared for the long haul. Well, anyway, we were there and 20 minutes, Tom. Wasn't even 20 minutes. Here he comes walking down the street with a child going to the park, probably about a 5-year-old. So Tyrone and I, we approach him on each side, grab his arms, put him behind his back, tell him he's under arrest, handcuff him. And so he's pretty calm, and he's telling us what kind of mistake we made. And he says, hey, tell so-and-so. He sends the kid back up to the house, tell her to bring my driver's license. So the girlfriend comes running down there, and she's got a paper driver's license without his picture. And she's talking about suing the police department and everything for false arrest, everything she's carrying on. So then I told her, I said, well, you got that right to do that, but he's going to jail because I know who he is. And that's not who he is on that driver's license. So Sergeant came down there, and he walked up to him. He looked at him. He said, hi, Tony. How you doing? He looked at the sergeant and said, that's not my name. So we take him downtown, Tom, and he get down the fingerprint ID. Back then, they didn't have the technology they have now.
Yeah.
So we get down.
You didn't have the electronic system back then.
No electronic system. So we get down the fingerprint ID, and the lady down there, she said, who do you think he is? I said, this is who I think he is. So she said, she pulled his card. Then she said, ask him, what's your name? He said, he said his real name. So he said his real name. So the jail was upstairs on the 8th floor. So we take him upstairs. We're on our way up to jail, and he told me what happened. He said, that dude, the murder that you got me on, he said, the dude was abusing his sister. That was his sister's boyfriend. He came over there when the sister called him, had a shotgun. They got into it. He shot him in the face and killed him. And he was on the run, Tom, for 6 months. And so years later, this was time after he got convicted for manslaughter and armed criminal action. Years later, this was about 10, 15 years later, I run into him and he could recant that story or how he was arrested by me verbatim, just like it happened. He said, I'll never forget it. He said, you knew. And I asked him, I said, how many times had you been stopped and they never figured out that wasn't you? And he said, there was several. He said, I thought I was cool because I got away with it. And so So that was, to me, Tom, that was the first really big arrest I had early in my career, you know, mm-hmm. that was significant, you know. And so from that point on, I have a number of them after that, but that would have been right around my rookie, you know, when I was a rookie, the first big one I had.
Now, you worked a bank robbery case. Tell me about that.
This was right before I retired. You know, right before I retired, I had a job or assignment where I was in patrol bureau. And mine, they call it staff inspection, but I basically worked the PM shift, and I had full authority during that time on major scenes or incidents, anything that would happen, to bring in any resources I could or needed to and do that. So I was always at all different zones. So one day my office was at Metro out on 7601 Prospect, and this would have been 2014, the year before I retired. I hear this bank robbery come out. And mm-hmm. so I'm driving up through that area and everything. I said, man, let me head this way. So they put out the pickup information for the bank at 85th and Holmes, suspect description of black male westbound. I said, okay, they got to come back with more than that. We need a vehicle description and everything. So I'm driving that way to get in the area. So I get up around 75th and Truce, which is about roughly maybe 10 blocks or so northeast of there, maybe a little further. So all of a sudden, the dispatcher comes on the air, and she says that we have a tracking ETA tracking device, what was on the money, and it's moving northbound on Truce. Okay. So we know at that time that it's mobile. It's in a vehicle or truck or something. So all these different detective officers converging on the area. So she's continuing to give us descriptions. So she says 75th. So the Truce is a major thoroughfare in Kansas City, yes, with a lot of traffic.
Yep.
And we don't have a vehicle description. All we have is this signal. And not
this
knowing where it's
signal. And that's because somebody at the bank put a tracker in the money bag.
In the money bag, yes. In the money bag. So when we get down to 63rd Street, and at that time the dispatcher came back and corrected the pickup information, and she said the suspect's a white male. So all mm-hmm. of a sudden there's a city bus there, and there's a Chevy Avalanche with one white male in it. So all of us get out, the officers, the TAC officers, detectives, and we draw down on this guy. And this guy's eyes as big as saucers. He puts his hands up. And before we can get him out, she comes back on the air and says, now westbound on 63rd. So we didn't have, we'd love to apologize to him, but we had to jump back in the cars and take off. So we're going westbound on eastbound on 63rd Street. And she says, now southbound on Meyer. Well, Meyer and Paseo, they split. One goes one direction, one goes the other. So I shoot up Meyer. And when I get up to around Meyer in Brooklyn, she gives another location of that I've passed. And I said, well, wait a minute. And so I called her on the phone. I said, how much of a delay is it? And she says, she thought it was about a minute. Well, it turned out mm-hmm. that it was pretty accurate to the current time when she gave. That's where he was at. So mm-hmm. I did a U-turn. And I sat on Paseo right across from the hospital, and I just started looking at all the people in different cars. So all of a sudden, this guy's coming up in a Taurus, a Ford Taurus, and he's pulling up, and I look at him, and he's a white male, and he's by himself. And I'm looking, mm-hmm. and there's another person by himself, and I'm thinking, it's got to be one of these two cars. I picked the Taurus. So I get behind him, and we go about another two blocks east, and we get to Prospect. And she's still giving the direction and giving the directions and everything. So she then gives a direction. She says, Meyer and Bruce R. Watkins, which we hadn't got to. So everybody speeds around me, and they said, what do you want to do? I said, I'm going to stay with him. So I get out, and the detective from Homicide's with me. He's behind me. So the guy, when I pull him over, he then rolls down his window, and he waves his arm for me to go around. So then I wave no back to him, and I'm pointing over to the curb. So he continues for about another block. Then he finally pulls over. So everybody pulls over. And at that moment, she gets on there and she gives another direction that's ahead of us. So I said, no, let's stick with him. So I got out and the detective got out. He says, I'll go up if you cover me. And I covered him. He went up. He got the guy out the car and brought him back and put him over to the side. And he had said something to him I couldn't hear. I said, what did he say? He said, well, if you look in the passenger seat, you'll find out why you stopped me. And so we went up to the passenger seat. There's the mask. There's the gun. There's the money. There's the tracking device and all that. So,
but you picked that Taurus on a hunch.
On a hunch. On a hunch. On a hunch time based on the time. And it was just, I guess, a sixth sense that just something was not normal about him when I looked at him the way he was driving. So I go back to the bank with the FBI and everybody up the bank. And I asked the lady, I said, how did you know? They said when he came in, he was covered, gloves, ski mask. You couldn't tell what race he was. So I said, well, how did you know he was white? She said the bank sent them to a class that taught them some how to identify people by race by listening to the sound of their voice. And I said, well, sound like money well spent by the bank on that. And so the next day, Tom, and this story changes, gets even a little bit more stranger. So the next day, the Kansas City Star puts an article in the paper. And I'm reading the article, and they named him the Romeo Bandit. His name was Edward Truex, Jr. And he's 47 years old. Well, at the time, 47.
This was not his first bank robbery?
Not his first robbery. So he tells the FBI that he robs the bank because his girlfriend was in jail and he needed to bond her out. So the reporter called him the Romeo Bandit. So I read it and I said, you know what? I'm 50 years old now. Don't get me wrong, Tom. I believe in love, but I've been a policeman. a long time too. So I called the captain. It was Dave Lindeman. I never forget. I called Dave. I said, Dave, I saw this article in the paper. And I got another take on it. And he said, what's that, Major? I said, he has a girlfriend in jail, but that's not why he robbed the bank. He robbed the bank because she told him, if you don't get me out of jail, I'm going to tell this about you and what else you did. And I said, now, I'm not trying to tell the FBI how to do their business or anything, but the car that he was driving belonged to her. But before they give that car back to her, they might want to have a little talk to her. So he said, I'll call him and pass it on. Well, it turns out that hunch was correct. She had been with him the night before or two nights before. They robbed a hotel and some other criminal activity that he was involved with. She got arrested. So he didn't have any money to get her out of jail. And she was getting ready to rat him off for his crimes if he didn't. So that's why
he had to rob a bank.
That's what he thought to get her out.
So that's an amazing story.
So they called him the Romeo robber.
We're going to take a brief pause so I can tell you about one of the supporters of PD Stories. As most of us have found out the hard way, getting into debt is easy. Getting out is hard, especially if your credit score isn't great. But there's something called Upstart.com. Hurry to Upstart.com/PD to find out how low your Upstart rate is. That's Upstart.com/PD. It's this neat lending platform that knows you're more than just your credit score and offers smarter interest rates to help you pay off high-interest credit card debt. It's fast, simple, and easy to check your rate. The best part? Once the loan is approved and accepted, most people get their funds the very next business day. See why Upstart is ranked number one in their category with over 300 businesses on Trustpilot. And hurry to upstart.com/PD to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes a few minutes. That's upstart.com/PD.
If you love true crime podcasts, Podcast One is the perfect destination. We've got two awesome true crime podcasts trending right now, and you have to check them out. First up, based on the iconic series on A&E, Cold Case Files explores some of the most difficult to solve murders, which stymied investigators and went cold, sometimes for decades. Next up, Autopsy is the latest podcast from Reels and Podcast One. Every episode takes you in depth with celebrity deaths and their true cause. Check out both Cold Case Files and Autopsy. They're going to be your next favorite true crime podcast. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
talk about Precious Doe. That's how I met you in 2001. Precious Doe was a child, 3-year-old girl, who was dismembered and her body parts scattered in a wooded area in Kansas City, and no one knew who she was, hence the name Precious Doe was given to this child. And that's how I first met you. I was with America's Most Wanted. We joined in trying to help identify this girl with the help of the public. It was one of the most, it's hard to even talk about it now, but it was just one of the most disturbing cases I ever worked on, I'm sure, and I know it was for you too.
Yes, at the time it happened, it was April 28th of 2001, when her body was found in a park in Kansas City near 59th and Kensington. Mm-hmm. And at the time, they did not know how old she was. It was a child. And she was wrapped in a trash bag. And once the media and the community found out about the homicide, it really touched a lot of people that someone would be that callous and have that much disregard for a human being and a 3-year-old who we consider defenseless 3-year-old, and to brutally murder her and then discard her body and wrap it in a trash bag like trash.
And beheaded her.
And beheaded her, yes. Her head was found 3 days later. There was a guy who lived in the area over there who was out walking who actually found the head, found her head. So after the homicide, there was a number of different attempts to get her identified. They did composite drawings. There were marches. There were, they canvassed the area looking for leads. There was a lot done. At that time, it was an ad hoc group against crime. It was under the leadership of Alvin Brooks there and a lot of other people in the community.
Councilman Brooks?
Yes, Councilman Brooks, mm-hmm. later became mm-hmm. a city councilman, that got behind that, and they raised money. And I think the reward, Tom, if I remember, got over $30,000.
Yes.
In the case. But even with that, the reward and everything that they did, and America's Most Wanted, that you, yourself, and the network and the show was very instrumental in following the Erica Green Precious Doe case and everything you did to bring public attention to it. Because we always think in law enforcement, no matter how many times that something's aired on television, it might be mm-hmm. someone who sees it for the first time that knows something about it, and you get the break you need to solve a case. So there was a lot of publicity surrounding this case. So it wasn't until 2005, towards the end of April. By that time, I had been promoted and transferred to violent crimes in the homicide unit in Kansas City, that we had information from one of our local community activists about the end of April of 2005 that he had been in contact with a tipster who had provided him information that he said he had called the police about, the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department about, and that he was not able to get anyone from the department to call him back or follow up his lead, but he knew who the little girl was and who her mother was and who was probably possibly involved in killing her.
And he was in Oklahoma, not Missouri.
Yes, he was in Oklahoma. He was in the state of Oklahoma. He was in the state of Oklahoma and not Missouri. And so once that information, I remember meeting Alonzo Washington on the first floor of police headquarters. And he gave me the envelope that the information was in, and supposedly also included DNA that they mm-hmm. had. So by May 5th of 2005, she was positively identified as Erica Green. And after she was identified from Erica Green, and the additional information we got from tipster led us to Oklahoma. And at Oklahoma, her mother and not her biological father, but her mother's boyfriend were both charged in connection with her murder. And extradited from Oklahoma back to Kansas City, awaiting trial. And it turned, and from what we understand or what the investigators learned, that she was beaten with an ashtray. She was beaten with an ashtray, and the mother actually put her body in a baby stroller and strolled her across the street to where they dumped her body. And the husband at the time, in an attempt to, in his mind, keep her from being identified, used a pair of hedge clippers to decapitate her and separate her body from the head from her body. And so both of those individuals now are serving. I think he's serving a life sentence.
He got life. Yeah, he got life.
And she got 25. And she got 25.
And she testified against him, too.
Yes, testified against him.
Yeah, it's one of those cases that we will never forget as long as we live. I mean, that girl would be the age of, Erica would be the age of finishing college now and living her life. But at least justice was finally served, and we all played a part in trying to help bring that case to a resolution. Now, there was another case we worked on together, and that was Shante Henderson. Now, Shante Henderson was, to me, I mean, I've hunted a lot of dangerous criminals over the last 20-some years, but Shante Henderson was one of the most interesting. She was a young black female who was part of a gang. I think it was a 12th Street gang.
5A students, yes.
Yep. And she was feared on the streets. Like, men feared. She was a gangster girl who was running around shooting people and blasting people and had a hit list. And I remember she ended up making the FBI's top 10 list. And tell us a little bit about the hunt for Shante Henderson and who she was, her reputation.
Yeah, she had a reputation for violence. She had associations with the 12th Street Gang, 5A Stoos, gangs and gang involvement. And she was actually on our radar screen before she killed DeAndre Parker at the BP station on Red Bridge in Kansas City. And that's where, that's the case where she was actually charged with that homicide. And mm-hmm. once she was identified and charged with that homicide, then that's when a lot of media attention to her was given to that particular case that she was involved with. And so we were unsuccessful in locating her. And eventually he got the attention of the FBI, and there was a $100,000 reward for her arrest.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it was, I believe, Tom, it was March 31st of 05. I believe that was the date. And you came mm-hmm. to Kansas City, and you and I were down somewhere around that time when they were getting ready to announce it. We were down on 12th Street. You and I were down there and looking at that area and talking. And after the day they announced it was the day she got caught. So she was mm-hmm. not really on. She was on the list maybe for
less than 24 hours. She was on the FBI's top 10 for less than 24 hours.
Yep, before she was arrested. So once
and
she
I
got
remember her perp walk. Her perp walk at police headquarters when they actually, had her walk before the TV cameras and my camera was there. And it was the most gangster perp walk ever. She was like even handcuffed, throwing up her gang signs,
throwing
like,
up her signs
from ear to ear. She was like straight hardcore. To me, Shante Henderson was like Omar in The Wire, because during those weeks when she was out on the street, there was rumors that she had this hit list of people she was going to kill. And she was a suspect, I believe, in at least five more murders that they maybe never closed on her, right?
Right. It was quite a few. It was. I don't remember what the exact number. But not only that, Tom, we also had cases where we had shooting victims who didn't die that she shot.
And
So she went away and then came and did, I think she did like 3 years, Tom, on a 10-year sentence.
She got like 10 years, I believe.
Yep, she did. And she got out on parole, probation.
And then what happened?
She got out. KCPD got her again on weapons charges. So then she had the felon in possession weapons charge. And so mm-hmm. I believe that she had to serve those two sentences consecutively or concurrently. I'm not sure which one, but she still should be incarcerated.
I mean, for the sake of the general public of Kansas City, I sure hope so, because she really did terrorize the city for a minute. People, Shante Henderson's coming. People like, they were ducking in houses when they thought Shante was on the street.
Oh, yeah. She was something else.
Now, you were on the police force for over 30 years. How did you get into law enforcement, choose it as a profession?
Well, Tom, it started for me a long time ago. When I was born and raised, as you know, in Kansas City, and my mom moved out to an area in South Central Kansas City. And at that time, there were very few African-American families that lived in the neighborhood. And we were one of the first over by Swope Park. Well, across the street from me was a couple, and the husband was a police officer. And he was my first experience or first time I've ever been around a police officer. He was a captain at the time with the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. And my mother, she still talks about it to this day. And she says, I came home one day, I was about 5 or 6 years old, all excited, and she didn't know what was wrong. And she says, what's wrong? What's wrong? And I told her, I said, I'm going to be a policeman, just like Glenn across the street. So it stuck with me then. I played all kinds of sports in high school and went to college and picked a college, Missouri Southern in Joplin, Missouri. And it's a university now, but they had criminal justice as a major, so it was a good fit for me. And so I played football 2 years, but I've really focused on my education, my degree in criminal justice, and I had an associate's degree in law enforcement. And I graduated from Missouri Southern in May of 84, and on December 3rd of 1984, I was joining the police academy. And that's how it all began for me.
Let me ask you a question about being an African-American rising up through the Kansas City Police Department. Did you have to deal with discrimination, and how hard or how easy was it for you to navigate your way through the bureaucracy of the police department, as well as some of the racial issues that were present and prevalent?
Tom, mine started actually in the application process. As far as experiencing from KCPD, any type of racial issues or anything that had to deal with me being African-American.
And so it started from the get-go.
But here's how it started. And apparently, and I didn't know this at the time, it was always assumed or believed that if you were African-American and you were from Kansas City, you were in the police computer. They had some kind of record on you. So when I went down to fill out my application right after I graduated from college, I filled it out. So the recruiter and the background investigator, they go off into another room. So they come back in. They said, let me make sure we got your information right. I said, what do you mean? And that's my driver's license and everything. He said, have you ever went by any other names or do you have a recent name change? I said, nope, I haven't. He said, well, don't get me wrong. We have not seen any black man that comes in here that doesn't have any record in our police computer. I said, well, you're looking at one now.
Wow.
Yeah. I said, you're looking at one now. And he says, why is that? I said, well, when I was coming up, the police.
Why is it that you young black men have not been in the system? Why is it?
I wasn't in the system, Tom. And I told him, I said, because the police never stopped you on a basketball court, baseball diamond, or football field. And that's where I always stayed. And so that was it. So, you know, moving on from there, early on in the career, I just didn't know what to expect. My father had always told me stories. And my father, Tom, he was not a fan of the police. Now, he was born in 1926, and he came from Arcadia, Louisiana. So he wasn't a fan of the police. You know, it's from the South and all of that. And
Jim Crow era.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I learned, and when he came to Kansas City, and he talked about how the police treated black people and everything like that. And so I had heard those stories and heard stories coming up, so I didn't know really what to expect, you know. And I knew my who I idolized and my mentor across the street, he was white, and he wasn't nothing like any of those stories that I heard. Mm-hmm. So I was pretty open, you know, but I wasn't naive either. So I don't feel like that, you know, I experienced anything directly towards me. I know there was some other always that fear or perception that blacks on the police department didn't get treated fairly when it came to discipline. They were more subject to harsher discipline or not given the benefit of the doubt if an issue came up, things like that. So I was always an advocate for diversity. I always wanted, and especially late in my career, I was always recruiting. And I felt like I was a role model. I felt like I was a role model for my community. I felt like that being black, it really benefited me as far as the relationships, the networking I had in the community. You know, to this day, Tom, I still have the same and only cell phone number I've ever had from the police department. I still have it. And one of the reasons is because so many people in the police, in the community had that cell phone number.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then as far as the crime, I can remember when I was a kid, man, Kansas City was so beautiful. You know, as far as the black community, the houses and everything and how the manicured the lawns were, the type of automobiles that African Americans had. Oh man, everything. And then to see all of that change as
in the 80s,
and now where we're at now. I mean, it's just really hard, you know, to see, you know, the level of violence that's plagued this city for years and the impact it has on our community, especially, you know, the black community, especially because when you look at with the homicides in Kansas City, traditionally 80% or more, 85% or more of those homicides occur in a very small area. And that is your predominantly African-American neighborhood. And it continues to be the same since I've retired. So those kind of things I took more personally, you know, on there. I've had a lot of great experiences, probably people that I would have never met. Especially, you know, when I think about this, what this career has done for me in terms of community involvement. When I retired, they said, well, what do you miss the most, Tony? I said, the people. People in the community, people in the neighborhoods, people that relied on you. They began to trust you, you know, trust you. You were there. You felt like because you were from that community and you understood certain things, relationships, things like that. Mm-hmm. You were able to go in there and easily navigate your way through things and make the situation better when we would have an incident that would come down there. And I can remember officers would be on a crime scene and they'd get ready to leave and I'd be over there talking to family or crowd and they'd look at me and they says, you want to stick around, sir? I said, no, I'm fine. Nobody gonna bother me. And that was my attitude, Tom, because that was my community. You know, I was respected in that community. I'd been there a long time. A lot of people knew me, and I just felt like, you know, was helping make a difference there. So we've been really fortunate in Kansas City, you know, over the years, since 1968, when we had the riot here in Kansas City, and after that, building in the community and building that relationship, because that relationship, when you have a situation, that's when that relationship get tested in the African-American community.
Mm-hmm.
And you will know if your relationship is strong. So you don't worry about it when it happens. You worry about it before it happens and you build on that relationship. So when I first came on time, we didn't have much community involvement. We got into community policing in the 80s. So we were heavily involved in community. So the police department recognized we need to work on building that relationship with the community. That even went years later, Tom, that even went into the new construction of our facilities. Well, one of the things that they want to do is that make sure we include space for the community. So all of those new stations have that space. So if the Deltas, the AKAs, the Kappas, the Qs, or whoever wants to have a meeting or people want to community groups, you can use it. We have a gym, Tom, in South Patrol with a weight room and state-of-the-art. For the public to use, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Space here to practice for basketball, for youth teams, it's really limited.
Mm-hmm.
We don't
mm-hmm.
charge a dime, Tom. We want the community to come in there. And that's to build that relationship with the community. Officers come in there and play basketball with the kids. We open it up for practices. The only thing they have to do is schedule in advance. So that's a lot of things that we've done to help build that relationship. So, and I think when you saw some of the things that happened here in Missouri in 2014,
Ferguson situation.
Yep, Ferguson, New York with Eric Garner, Baton Rouge, when we had the
Sandra
incident.
Sandra Bland.
Mm-hmm, yep. And Tom, I don't know if you realize this or not, and I won't say his name. He was here from Kansas City. He went after the Alton Sterling shooting or incident that happened in Baton Rouge.
Right.
It would have been in 2016 in July. He traveled 700 miles from here to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He shot six officers. Three lost their life.
Oh, yes, yes.
He was born and raised in Kansas City, Missouri. So when I heard about that, Tom, and when you read the history on him, traveling around to these protests, traveling around these cities. I think he was in Dallas, after that incident happened in Dallas, and then he went down there. I said, just think, if we would have had one of those type of incidents, he would have extracted that violence against members of the Kansas City Police Department right here. He wouldn't have had to travel. Mm-hmm. Yes. And that was just amazing, Tom. And fortunately, we've had incidents, don't get me wrong. And we've had the public come out and speak against it. But at that time, Tom, we didn't have anything that rose to that level that got his attention. Or I really believe he would have done that here. Mm-hmm. He would have done that.
Have you ever fired your gun in the line of duty?
Yes, I have. And Tom, I can tell you, in the line of duty, and twice, it was on in incidents involving vicious pit bulls. That's the only time I've ever had to fire it.
You never had to shoot at a person. You only shot at pit bulls.
Pit bulls.
I can understand having to defend yourself against a vicious dog.
Yep, pit bulls. That's what it was.
What happened?
Well, it was me. I was in SWAT, our support unit, and we got a call from homicide, and they were looking for this guy. Involved in it, wanted for a homicide, and they told us who he hung out with. Well, we knew the guy who he hung out with. So we were looking for him. So me and my partner, we parked down the street on 31st Street over in East Zone, and we're walking up to the house. And all of a sudden, there's this huge pit bull. And this pit bull's charging at us, Tom. And my first instinct was to run or try to get back in the car, right? My partner jumps behind me. So I can't, he jumps behind me and I can't get out of there, right? So instinctively through the training, I fired one shot and I hit the dog, and the dog takes off up the street, didn't kill him. And so my partner, and never forget this, he walks up there and he's saying, oh, the dog is still, the dog's in pain, dog's suffering. And he wants to take the dog out of suffering. He said, well, Tony, you got a right to report. He pulls out his gun, fires one shot, stands in front of the dog point blank, and misses the dog on the ground. And then animal control comes and takes the dog away.
Let me get this straight. The dog is wounded and down.
And
he's going to finish it off to put it out of its misery, and he misses?
He misses the dog. Yep. He misses the dog.
Wow.
Yep.
Now, Major L, today a lot of police departments across the country and sheriff's departments are having difficulty finding people to become recruits to join these departments. I know where I live, it's a county of 1.5 million people. They just put out a request for new candidates, and they only got 15. What would you say needs to be done to make policing more attractive to people in this era that we're in now where it's not so attractive to a lot of people?
That's a great question, Tom. It's something over my 30 years KCPD struggled with. And we didn't have the climate or the environment we have as far as social media and the police perceptions, other opportunities for employment and advancement that they have now, where in the African-American community, you look at what other options I have for a career or whatever. There's more than when I came on over 30 years ago. I would urge police departments to get youths involved or get young people involved at an early age. That's when it clicked for me when I was young. And that's when I think the police departments are have to continue to do, look at other avenues to recruit, look at some of the officers that they have. What do you need? What are some of the obstacles that you can address to help you recruit more qualified minority applicants? And not just minority applicants, like you said, Tom, they only got 15 across the board. It's affecting, populations that it didn't affect before, non-minorities as far as police applicants put in. I can remember, Tom, when I was in HR and I was a sergeant, we would have hundreds or several, couple thousand applications. And then we would always say, in order to get 35 to 44 recruit class, we'll go through 2,000 applications. Well, we don't have that anymore per recruit class. So we got to find ways to, make this our career you know, attractive to people again, where people want to get involved, want to do police work, and want to be a part of a good department. But they have to, you know, find out what their needs are. You know, some departments have issues with pay, and they don't pay well. You know, and there's other, you know, professions that we're competing with. I mean, you got some down in private sector in some areas are paying more than the police department.
And armed security. I mean, there are armed security jobs that start out at $75,000 a year.
Yep. So the recruiting, you know, has a lot of issues to address. But I think now it's more challenging than ever. I mean, you know, when I first started, Tom, it's police work. Don't get me wrong. Police work has its degree of danger. But the level of danger when I first started on for a new officer and somebody thinking about coming on was different. What we dealt with in the 60s and the 70s, the 60s and late during the civil unrest, the Black Panthers, a lot of that social unrest was going on, the riots. You had policemen who were actually killed for doing nothing more than their job or sitting at a stoplight or sitting there and someone that wanted to strike out against the system, and some of these radical groups or radical individuals would assassinate. Well, when I came on in 84, we were well beyond that. I didn't have that fear. It wasn't until 2014 when that started again with some of the movement, what was going on. So now you had that. And I can never forget my wife, before I retired, she was very, not that she's not normally, but she got even more concerned because she knew I rode around all the time by myself in the evening at night. And I'd stop at different places. And she said, well, you ever think about that somebody could come up and just shoot you like that? I said, I never had to before, but I have to think about it now. Well, that atmosphere is it's not as pervasive as it was when we had in 2014, 2015, even 2016, where people just come up and assassinate a policeman just sitting in a car. But that thought is still there in the minds of a lot of young people that makes that a not an attractive job. I don't want a job where I'm going to be attacked or I could be shot or I could be killed or I'm looked at as a target on my back. You know, that hurts as far as people being interested in a career in law enforcement because that now that danger's really elevated beyond what it would normally be in the course of, you know, doing your job. So we got to we have to, you know, try to address some of these issues and some of these things we have. And I think, you know, the big buzzword since 2014 in not buzzword, but what the movement has been for reforms in criminal justice, reforms in law enforcement. And that's
which are needed, which are desperately needed.
Yes, desperately needed. And that's time the next thing that I'm really waiting for to see how all of this changes law enforcement and how it evolves, you know, from where we are now. So much have changed as far as that, you know, there in policing, that it's still an interesting career. It's still a very rewarding career, very satisfying career, one I'd recommend for anybody any day.
Well, that's what we love about Live PD is that we're able to show people policing across the country with different departments. And we've seen that recruitment has gone up in departments that have been featured on the show, like Richland County Sheriff's Office, for example. They get people applying from all over the country who have watched for almost in our fourth season now that department on the show from the very first episode. And they say, you know what? I like the way they conduct themselves. I'd like to be a Richland County Sheriff's Deputy. So that's one of the things that that I think Live PD has brought to the image of policing, and you know, we're just glad that some people are able to look at it and say, yes, this is something I want to do.
Well, I tell you this, you are really an amazing storyteller. You've got a memory like Rain Man. I'm telling you, I don't know anybody that can remember addresses and dates and times and names like you. I mean, just an amazing recollection. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Major Anthony L. Retired Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. I am so happy we had the time to spend together on PD Stories. You continue to do your job out there in the private sector, keeping things secure and safe. And I'll see you for a Gates Barbecue sometime down the road in Kansas City. Thank you so much.
You are very welcome.
Thank you for joining us today on PD Stories. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. And like us on Facebook.com/PD Stories for more information. You can also catch me on A&E's Live PD every Friday and Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern. PD Stories was created and executive produced by Sue Funk, with producer Julie Magruder. Our editor is Steve Delamater. Special thanks to McKamey Lynn, Tisa Cassidy, Alicia Acuff, and the teams at A&E Networks and Podcast One for making this show possible. Until next time, I'm Tom Morris Jr.